Do you know when King Cove saw its most recent medevac?
I'm not aware of their most recent
medevac. It was Sunday.
Senator Murkowski grills Interior Secretary Sally Jewell in Congress. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage residents try to find solutions to the lack of detox beds in the city.
One thing we heard, if you can't get people into treatment in that narrow window when they ask for help, then you've lost them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, gives Alaska Native students the inspiration and opportunity to excel in science and engineering careers, building a sustainable future for Alaska. More at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Senator Lisa Murkowski confronted Interior Secretary Sally Jewell today at a hearing of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. The subject was the president's proposed budget for the Interior Department, but Murkowski used the occasion to bash Jewell for recent department decisions blocking oil development on the North Slope. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Murkowski chairs the Energy Committee, so this was her highest profile opportunity to let Jewell have it.
Interior's decisions are hurting Alaskans. You're depriving us of jobs, revenues, security, and prosperity.
Murkowski says the Obama administration, by putting 22 million acres of Arctic land and waters off limits in recent weeks, will starve the Trans-Alaska pipeline of oil. Jewell says that's not her intent, and she suggests it's not the government's fault.
Senator, I am fully committed to supporting the efforts in the North Slope of Alaska to keep the Trans-Alaska pipeline full. As you know, I worked on that pipeline as a college student, as a petroleum engineer. I understand how fields peak, and Prudhoe Bay oil field and related oil fields have been past their peak production for some time. I'm aware of that.
The Interior Secretary says her department is only protecting areas that have the highest ecological value or those identified by subsistence whalers. Jewell says in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, 72% of the estimated recoverable oil is in areas open to leasing.
And we have recently approved ConocoPhillips' preferred proposal for drilling in the National Petroleum Reserve. Offshore, 90% of the estimated recoverable oil and gas will be available for leasing in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas.
Murkowski also brought up another sore point, the road that could connect King Cove to Cold Bay. Murkowski says if sick and injured people could get to Cold Bay's larger airport, they could more safely reach a hospital. But Jewell rejected a proposed 10-mile road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge to connect the communities.
Do you know when King Cove saw its most recent medevac?
I'm not aware of their most recent medevac.
It was Sunday night. Do you know how many medevacs have been carried out so far in 2015?
I do not.
There's been 5.
And Murkowski says there have been 21 medevacs, some by Coast Guard helicopter, from King Cove in the 14 months since Jewell rejected the single-lane gravel road. Jewell says her trip to Kivalina last week reminded her that King Cove isn't the only Alaska community with difficult access.
There are many villages that struggle in the case of medical evacuations, and I appreciate that it is part of our job to work on that, and I will continue to work with you on it.
That is true that there are many villages, but there are none that have ready access to an all-weather airport right there.
Murkowski says she's dismayed the president's budget includes no solutions for King Cove. Jewell says Interior is considering alternative access through the refuge, maybe by air or water. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
As of today, it is no longer a crime to possess or transport up to an ounce of marijuana in the state of Alaska. However, the rule change is still a long way from the fully legal and regulated market that voters passed with Ballot Measure 2. And as state entities work to develop comprehensive new laws on a new commodity, municipalities are rushing to find shorter-term public safety solutions. KSKA's Zechariah Hughes reports.
Yesterday, Governor Bill Walker introduced legislation that would create a marijuana control board under the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The group will be in charge of designing regulations as the state's permit structure takes shape in the year ahead. The board is similar to the Alcoholic Beverages Control Board, which oversees liquor licenses for the state, and a comprehensive framework for legalizing marijuana is proceeding steadily through the legislature. Bruce Schulte is a spokesman for the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation, which is offering policy recommendations to lawmakers on transitioning to a legal marijuana market.
We're pretty happy with Senate Bill 30 the way it is right now.
Legalization advocates are using money from supporters and the Marijuana Policy Project to fund a Consume Responsibly campaign, featuring bus ads in Anchorage the next 2 weeks with the slogan, "With great marijuana laws comes great responsibility." The message puts the burden of restraint on consumers, asking for a good neighbor approach. The ABC board met this morning for an emergency session that extended bans on consuming alcohol in public to marijuana. That's a step that some municipalities have already taken on themselves.
We have to do something, I think, to make sure that their public is safe.
Paul Honeman is a member of the Anchorage Assembly. The Anchorage ban on public consumption comes with a $100 fine, similar to a parking ticket. At a special session convened today, the Assembly unanimously passed another public safety measure on a process that extracts the active ingredient in cannabis for concentrated, highly potent byproducts. The measure intends to maintain a ban on certain rendering processes that have caused dozens of house explosions in Colorado since legalization. Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew is working closely with the Assembly to develop reasonable enforcement policies, in part because he wants the department to be ready for new developments before they become a problem.
Whether it's the butane hash oil scenario we saw there or more advanced equipment, you know, I can't tell you that, but I do know we have actionable information about people who've ordered and received stuff that would be, I believe, illegal under the current ordinance.
Critics say the measure is unnecessarily broad and would be more effective with a refined language, but the Assembly in Anchorage is taking the approach that it's better to do something than nothing, and that it can always repeal the rules once state measures are released later on. In Anchorage, I'm Zechariah Hughes.
State attorneys are about to finish questioning witnesses for the defense in a trial that could determine whether or not the state removes some restrictions for Medicaid-funded abortions for low-income women. Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest filed suit against the State Department of Health and Social Services, alleging that the state statute restricting Medicaid abortions puts a burden on pregnant women of low economic status because physical and mental health risks related to pregnancy are exacerbated by poverty. State Assistant Attorney General Margaret Payton Walsh says the state statute passed last year was enjoined before it went into effect. The law lists specific life-threatening physical conditions as criteria for women seeking Medicaid-paid abortions. Peyton Walsh says Medicaid puts restrictions on other types of medical payments, too.
That we've offered us exhibits and evidence in this case to show that Medicaid applies these sorts of criteria in lots of different ways. And there's nothing particularly unusual about this setup where you have to meet a special sort of set of circumstances in order for Medicaid to reimburse.
Peyton Walsh says the statute only seeks to limit Medicaid-paid abortions to those that are medically necessary.
We need to understand what makes an abortion medically necessary, so there needs to be a definition. This statute is designed to create that definition and to try to exclude what most people would think of as being elective abortion.
Planned Parenthood Chief Counsel Laura Einstein argues that socioeconomic factors are valid reasons for abortion.
We're talking about the most vulnerable population. These are women who are already on Medicaid, so already they are people who will be struggling economically, and some of them in a much more destitute situation. So when you start suggesting that they don't have a medical reason to have an abortion, and then you couple that with the financial burden that falls on them in trying to pay for that service themselves, then we think that's a serious constitutional violation.
Einstein says medicine is not a list of conditions and that physicians need to take into account the totality of a patient's circumstances.
What we're hoping to achieve is that the judge strikes down the statute and the regulation, that those are so limiting that they violate a woman's right to abortion, which is a right she has under the Alaska Constitution.
Closing statements are expected to be heard tomorrow. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage lawmaker argues for less in per diem pay.
I think I should put my money where my mouth is. Kristen, can I have my purse, please?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
Doyon Limited, announcing the 2015 Board of Directors election, encouraging e-proxy or paper proxy submission no later than Tuesday, March 10th before 5 p.m. Information at doyon.com.
It's now been a full month since regular helicopter service was halted to the remote Bering Strait community of Little Diomede. The aviation company flying to the island village says a combination of mechanical issues and weather is keeping flights from resuming, and residents say they're getting by despite just one delivery of mail and cargo in the last month. Oregon-based Erickson Aviation contracts with the regional nonprofit Coeric to provide what's known as essential air service, but the only helicopter flying from Nome to Diomede and back went to Anchorage in January for maintenance. A spokesperson for Erickson says a replacement helicopter made it as far as McGrath last week before freezing rain kept it grounded. Today, the company launched a larger helicopter from Anchorage and says they hope to get the craft to Nome within the next few days. Bethel community members are reacting to the Walker administration's firing of District Attorney June Stein. While working in the office on Sunday, Stein received a letter delivered from a deputy attorney general of her, quote, impending release. The state is not explaining why she's being fired. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
Stein did not want to be recorded, but said in an interview her termination came as a surprise. It was no surprise to local attorney Jim Valcarci, who often argues cases in her court, and says he's been sounding the alarm about Stein to anyone who would listen, including the governor.
She was not effective. She catered to certain white segments of the population, in my opinion, and she failed to work with those that needed our support the most.
Valcarci, a 20-year Bethel attorney who served on Governor Walker's transition team for public safety, said he saw a troubling trend in the Bethel court under Stein's leadership.
Young men in this area pleading out at arraignment to DV assault force, their lives are ruined. They're never going to work in any state jobs. They're never going to work in the good jobs in the village. And it sounds great when you say, well, we're being tough on crime. We're putting away these wife beaters. You know, DV is so broad out here. That's why we have the highest rate of domestic violence, because DV is anybody. If it was a former girlfriend, if you live together, brothers, sisters.
Valcarci thinks most young first-time offenders shouldn't end up in jail. He advocates for tribal courts where the community is actively involved in resolving misdemeanors and low-level offenses and what he calls smart justice. Myron Angstman, another attorney who's worked in Bethel for 40 years, has a different opinion.
She's consistent, she works hard, and she is competent.
He says the position Stein filled is a difficult one because of the huge caseload and the transience of attorneys willing to work in the bush, and he worries about her departure.
It's a tough position to fill, and you just don't cut loose somebody who's doing a decent job without a plan, and I have no knowledge of whether they have a plan, but I can tell you this, without any question, I have misgivings about whether their plan will work if they have one, because people who show up here don't always work out here.
Florina Altschiller was a prosecutor based in Anchorage for a couple of years and worked several trials in Bethel with Stein.
The impression that I got was that she was very dedicated to the office and to the Bethel community and to doing her job. I mean, she would literally wake up, work, and then go to sleep and repeat.
Altshuler is no longer with the Department of Law. She's originally from New York City and works in New York State now. In an interview, Stein said about her firing, quote, "I didn't believe it would happen because I didn't think a defense attorney would be able to get me fired," end quote, referring to Valcarcy. Valcarcy says he's been outspoken about his opposition to the way Stein had been running the office. He says he doesn't know if his complaints had anything to do with her firing. The governor's office confirms Stein has been fired, but won't comment further because it's a personnel issue. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
People packed the pews at the First Covenant Church in Anchorage last night to discuss the municipality's lack of detox facilities. The city of 300,000 people has only 14 detox beds. Before 2000, there were 34. KSK's Ann Hillman listened as community members presented their concerns to assembly members and hoped for solutions.
Detox facilities provide medical interventions for people withdrawing from large amounts of alcohol or drugs and help them manage the symptoms. The only detox facility serving Anchorage and the Valley is the Ernie Turner Center, which turns away about 15 to 20 people every day. Waiting lists run an average of 10 days. Heidi and Thomas Jensen researched the issue for Anchorage Faith and Action Congregations Together, or AFACT, then presented the data to the community.
One thing we heard: if you can't get people into treatment in that narrow window when they ask for help, then you've lost them.
The Jensens say the problem isn't new. The municipality and other organizations have issued 20 major reports on homelessness and alcoholism in the city since 1978. Most of them call for more detox beds. Residents like Ada Shavings lined up to ask assembly members Bill Evans and Dick Traney for action.
A lot of our friends, about 15 to 20 of them, has passed away just from waiting to get into treatment. A lot of them have died on the street.
Laura Evans said she wanted the assembly members to see the face of someone who needed detox, received it, and is now in recovery.
And I just ask for your think about us who really need help when you think about getting more detox beds.
Heather Smith was a pastor on the North Slope for 9 years. She said people in her congregation wanted help finding detox facilities anywhere in the Northwest, but she could only find spots for two of them.
Those two people went through detox and rehab and are now leaders in their communities. Someone asked me as I was telling them this story, what happened to the others? And I'll tell you, many took their lives. Some died of alcohol poisoning. And I did their funerals.
Assemblymember Evans says he's heard all of these comments before, and he knows there's a problem.
There's really nothing new under the sun as far as what is needed. The biggest problem, as I see it, is that, like the presenter said, you need to transform the study into action. And basically, action is not as easy as it seems.
Evans says the assembly needs to take a nuanced approach to help people heal from addictions. Funding needs to go towards detox, treatment, housing, and support systems, but it's unclear where the money will come from. Assemblymember Traney says the action starts with more people speaking out, especially at assembly meetings and during the budget process.
Come to assembly meetings, item 17, the end of the agenda, I know I'm asking to do a lot. I want you to stay to the end of the meeting. Then you can talk to assembly about anything you want for 3 minutes. So what I want is every other month or every month, I want one of you from this committee to come and talk to the entire assembly. Until we're tired of seeing you, we get progress on this.
Heidi Jensen says it's time for action, not just talk.
Untreated substance abuse in Anchorage results in unnecessary costs to the community, compromised public safety, and suffering for our families.
In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you're 50 or over, this message is for you. Preventing colon cancer or finding it early doesn't have to be expensive. Most insurance plans and Medicare help pay for screening, and there are simple, affordable tests available that can be done in the privacy of your own home. Talk with your doctor about colon screening today. More at alaskacolonhealth.org. This message sponsored by Ride for Life.
A week after filing a bill that would prohibit legislators from collecting per diem when not in the Capitol, Representative Harriet Drummond has pledged to return some of her own daily allowance. The Democrat will fly home to Anchorage for a caucus meeting this weekend.
I think I should put my money where my mouth is. Kristen, can I have my purse, please? I'm getting paid $237 a day, and I'll be gone for 3 days. And I'm going to write a check for $771 to Alaska's Best Beginnings program,
which is 3 days per diem and then some. Drummond believes her check is needed because the state is facing a multi-billion dollar deficit and programs like the one she will donate to are likely to face budget cuts. Drummond says legislators should have to share some of that burden.
I'll be sleeping in my own bed and cooking in my own kitchen, and yet I'm being paid $237 for each of those days to be in Juneau.
Right now, legislators are paid out of their per diem for food and lodging in bulk at the beginning of session. Drummond's bill would require changes to the way allowance money is accounted. Her bill does not make exceptions for travel with a legislative purpose or for personal emergencies. So far, the bill has not been scheduled for any committee hearings. Several hundred people turned out last night to show support for the military in Alaska and speak against potential troop reductions. Pentagon officials toured Anchorage for much of the day, leading up to a concert packed with boosters at the Denaina Center downtown. John McLaurin is the Deputy Director for Managing Force Reductions Nationwide and says community support factors into decisions on cuts.
Number one, y'all are incredible. That assemblage outside before coming in here is something I've never seen before. You should be very proud of yourself because I am flat out impressed. So thank you very much for that.
The visit is part of the military's drawdown of 120,000 troops by 2018. Alaska could lose more than 11,000 Army positions, bringing thousands more dependents and family members out of state as well. The city administration and Anchorage Economic Development Corporation have taken the lead, bringing civic and business leaders together to stress the financial importance of the military to the state. But many members of the public, like retired Colonel Peter Goldberg, says it's the lifestyle available in Alaska that causes so many service members to stay and maintain relations with the armed forces.
Ask yourself if it is the kind of place that would encourage you to reenlist. The recreation here is superb. This is a paradise.
Pentagon officials have hard choices to make in the months ahead as they visit all 30 of the communities that stand to be hit by base reductions. Art Bell is the commander of American Legion Post 1 in Anchorage and is skeptical community input will carry much weight.
My honest opinion is that this is a dog and pony show, that Department of Defense is here tonight because they're required by law to be here and to have public hearings. I don't believe that that's going to influence the final decisions. I do believe we will lose troops from Alaska from both bases. But I do believe that that's a mistake.
State and local officials are pushing hard to insulate Alaska from the cuts. All three members of the congressional delegation testified. Some king salmon reared in southeast Alaska are traveling farther north as ocean temperatures rise. This news was delivered to the Alaska Board of Fisheries as their spring meeting opened in Sitka Monday afternoon. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The three-year meeting cycle of the Board of Fish is designed to take the board to different regions of the state, and a substantial portion of each 10-day meeting is devoted to education of the board. Regional managers and biologists from the Department of Fish and Game deliver literally reams of data about salmon harvest levels, escapement, and economics. Most of this information rolls in and out with the tide and generates little comment from the board, but this fact caught their attention. The king salmon hatched in Southeast's four top-producing river systems, the Alsek, Situk, Taku, and Stikine, are going very far afield. This is ADF&G Sport Fish Coordinator Ed Jones.
All four of these stocks are considered outside rearing, or what we term the far north migrators. This means that shortly after the juveniles enter the marine to rear, they essentially take a right and head straight out to the Gulf of Alaska and Bering Sea.
Again, these rivers are the four largest producers of king salmon in Southeast. Board member Orville Huntington wanted to know more.
Do you guys know where it is they're going?
Jones knows exactly where the kings are going. The National Marine Fisheries Service has increased trawl surveys in the Western Gulf in recent years. The surveys are catching king salmon, some of which have tiny coated wire tags embedded in their skulls. Those salmon were tagged in Southeast, says Jones.
They are typically found from Kodiak West. And in years, what's really interesting to me is in years of really warm water, which took place in 2005 and 2006, most of our coated wire tags in those years were found north in the Bering Sea. So that told me, well, it was evidence to me to suggest that the fish are being opportunistic and they're moving with water temperatures. They're going out to that part of the world and then they're moving as water temperatures dictate.
Board member Sue Jeffrey asked Jones to elaborate on this idea.
You're saying that warmer waters create different patterns, are they moving to cooler waters then?
Through the chair, Ms. Jeffrey, in 2005 and 6, it was warm water years. Those were very warm, and in that year, we actually found, they sampled, for instance, a Taku coated wire tag all the way up by St. Matthews Island, which is quite a bit north in the Bering Sea. But that's what's going on. The fish have a preferred temperature that their feed is in, that they like to operate in, and they're moving with it.
Although the Taku, Alsek, Situk, and Stikine produce most of Southeast king salmon, Jones said that there are seven smaller stocks that the department considers inside rearing. Once these fish enter the marine environment as juveniles, Jones said they remain in regional waters until maturity. Reporting from the Alaska Board of Fisheries meeting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Daisha Eaton in Bethel, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The American Lung Association of Alaska invites you to join their premier annual cycling event, the Clean Air Challenge, on May 9th. This family-friendly one-day event begins in Talkeetna and offers routes ranging from 10 to 100 miles. This fundraiser benefits the American Lung Association to support lung health programs across Alaska. For more information, visit cleanairchallengeak.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.